About a dozen years ago, our upcoming guest followed an unexpected opportunity to start a new business founded in workforce housing. The company would endure the ups and downs of the next decade, a dramatic marketplace, including the pandemic, of course, as it grew into a diversified and highly regarded platform. On this episode, we look at the landscape through the eyes of this veteran investor to learn from the instincts and experience that built a multi-billion dollar multifamily enterprise.
Right now, the sponsor's not in the driver's seat. The equity's in the driver's seat. And so there's a cautious optimism out there.
That's Bob Hart, the president and CEO of True America, a company based in Los Angeles since its inception in 2013. Today, True America has a national portfolio with $17 billion of assets under management and is one of the top multifamily owners in the United States. Bob's not only a housing leader, but also a podcast host in his own right with a program called Building Better Communities. Coming up, insights for building better communities, building an entrepreneurial career, and of course, building long-term asset performance in the multifamily space. I'm Spencer Levy, and that's right now on The Weekly Take. Welcome to The Weekly Take, and we are delighted to have one of the largest multifamily owners in the United States, Bob Hart of True America. Bob, thanks for joining the show.
Spencer, thank you for having me.
So, Bob, most people don't know True America. Well, actually, your residents do, but tell our audience what True America does.
Let me start out by saying that I've been involved in multifamily personally for over four decades. So it's been the embodiment of my career. And True America, when I formed it in June of 13, was what I hope will be the culmination of that in the company we started, which was dedicated to the growth, rehabilitation, and management of workforce housing around the United States. We started the company with Guardian Life Insurance Company, who's our partner today, with $10 million of working capital and 10 people. Today, we stand at $17 billion of assets and growing, about 65,000 units under management across 40 MSAs in 17 states. So we're very proud of our growth and what we've established as a company across the multifamily platform.
Well, that's a tremendous story, Bob. And I know you spent time prior to this at Kennedy Wilson. You were at Heitman,
yes.
But you decided to put out your own shingle. What motivated you to do that?
Well, at the time, Spencer, I really wasn't planning a transition. I had been enjoying a career that I had developed at Kennedy Wilson starting 26 years ago when I joined them as an acquisition officer, having followed the downturn period of the early 90s and continued doing workouts for 7 years up until 2000. So I started out as an acquisition officer there and built a multifamily platform within the New York Stock Exchange company, Kennedy Wilson. We built Kennedy Wilson Multifamily, a subsidiary that I'm proud to say still exists today. And the team that I put in place there over the years is still there running it. When I made the turn toward True America, it sort of happened in an organic, unexpected way. I had gotten to know Guardian Life Insurance. They enjoyed working with me and my group, and they wanted to build a platform which I could lead for them. And those conversations over a period of years led to the formation of True America. So I give them a lot of credit for putting that thought into me that I could basically do the same thing, but with my own platform with them.
When you change jobs, whether it's changing from an identical or similar organization or to do something as entrepreneurial as you did yourself, Bob, the single biggest limiting factor is your tolerance for risk. And
exactly.
How did you overcome that tolerance for risk?
I've always been a risk taker. I started investing for my own account in my 20s before I could even spell real estate. I started out very humbly, bought a duplex in LA as a 28-year-old and started investing a lot. So I've always had a high tolerance for risk, but I've always done it in a measured way without using synthetic financing like preferred and mezz, always putting in a lot of equity, always making sure I had the right amount of debt, not too much. And as a result of that, we've never had to give anything back to a bank, even in any downturn. We've always worked through it. So, you know, as you know, real estate is a risky business. Once it was described to me as a pig that sucks and devours cash. So you have to be prepared. And if you're going to take risk, you've got to be prepared on the other end of that risk.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about multifamily now. Let's start with the big picture. 5-6 years ago, we were in an incredibly low interest rate environment. The demand side was better. The supply side wasn't quite as big as it was today. So it's an academic way of saying the market has changed, not necessarily for the better in the last 5 or 6 years. How do you see it?
Well, 5 or 6 years ago, we were caught in this, I don't even know the right word to describe it. It was a phenomena created by the onset of COVID with the U.S. Treasury pumping a lot of money into the system. And this created a larger-than-life demand for apartments and for suburban apartments throughout the United States. And as a result, it created very, very high rent growth coupled with extremely low interest rates that we hadn't seen, at least in my time in real estate. And we were sort of all in Disneyland. Someone had to pinch you to say, hey, stop. This isn't real. This isn't going to continue. And what we're living with now is the reality, the smoothing out of that big, big curve that was stimulated by cheap money and excess demand for apartments.
And so how would you describe today's market overall?
I would use the word, it's much more sober. I think growth has to catch up again because we're still absorbing supply. Although we have household formation in the United States, I think this may be the first year of neutral or declining household formation. And I think that growth is flat in most markets, although there are green shoots emerging again, but we're not talking about the COVID growth of, you know, double digit.
We're going to get into asset types in just a moment. Any markets in particular you find to be most attractive? Would love to hear your answer.
Well, the Midwest has been the big sleeper. While the coasts were growing like mad over the last 5 or 6 years, the Midwest just maintained a steady, progressive growth that wasn't hit with oversupply. And that's why markets like Columbus, Ohio, and Kansas City, Missouri, or other spots in Indiana and other places in the Midwest have all done steadily well. The coastal markets have been on everybody's radar because it's where the brains of the country tend to go. And if you follow the phenomena of growth of young people, that's why New York City is so strong. It has the highest influx of young people. I think it leads the nation in dating apps and all these things. And it's created this phenomenal apartment growth in New York Metro. So we've concentrated on markets now that are outside the Sun Belt, like New Jersey. We just bought a very large deal in Somerset, New Jersey, which we're very happy with. And I think those markets surrounding New York City are going to continue to do very well for the foreseeable future.
Well, I think New York City, if I look at my statistics, is the number one growth market for market rate product rent. And I think San Francisco might be number two. And these are markets where it's very difficult to bring in new supply, and they're bringing in, but they are bringing in a new supply of highly educated individuals will pay market rents. Is that a fair way to put it?
That's a fair way to put it. I mean, San Francisco, New York, Austin, these are markets where, and Austin's a different phenomenon because it's had so much supply, but it's had young talent and young population growth. And I think that's why we're seeing what we're seeing. And the Bay Area is a little different, Spencer, in that it's a much smaller place than New York or Los Angeles. When it's gone down quickly. When it's come back quickly. And a lot of the smart money was buying there 2 or 3 years ago. So we're seeing tremendous comeback in and around the San Francisco Bay Area.
Let's talk now about the various asset types that you focus on. You do market rate, you do affordable, you build, you do structured finance. Of these areas, which looks most attractive today?
Well, let me start with, we stay focused on our core business. So we believe that workforce housing is still a very good business. And that is the centerpiece of what we do from an acquisition, management, rehabilitation, repositioning standpoint. We have diversified our offering in that we also buy core real estate for some separate accounts we have in select markets, and core has been very good of late. And then we also pivoted toward, we were never a developer until recently. In the last 5 years, we started to diversify into development, starting with build for rent and now doing market rate. And because we're now in the affordable housing business in a bigger way, we're going to be doing more and more affordable housing. Affordable is probably the stickiest category in the country. It's where the greatest demand is. And we're doing a lot of infill projects in and around California, north and south. We like that business a lot. And we made a big commitment to the LIHTC business 3 years ago. And we've acquired about 5,500 units across 50 plus buildings. And we're going to build on that business and build out that infrastructure.
So for our listeners, LIHTC stands for Low-Income Housing Tax Credits. That is the capital A affordable for people in the business. That's the capital A. And then that is contrasted with what many call, and I'll go to you, Bob, in this workforce housing. And workforce housing, which may incorporate some form of capital A, but doesn't necessarily have to. And in fact, correct me if I'm wrong, Bob, you just raised a large fund in that area.
Yes, we did. We raised an aligned fund with a large insurance company, Manual Life, and we've enjoyed a great relationship with them. We've done a lot of things with insurance companies over the past 13 and a half years, and Manual Life is one of the great ones, and we've enjoyed this relationship with them that's growing.
But let me ask a direct question, because we have a lot of developers on this show, and recognizing that development isn't your core, it's sort of a new add-on to it.
Right.
But are you finding that acquisitions are more attractive today than new build?
New build is still tough, Spencer. It just, there's no way around it, because costs are still very high and the capital wants a big enough spread. They want to see 6.5% to 7% a spread. And it's hard to achieve that in many markets because the costs are so high. But I think development is getting done. It's going to be getting done at a slower pace, which I think will normalize the markets. But with affordable, you don't need that. You have other things working for you in terms of subsidy and soft money and everything else. So it's really a matter of entitlements, putting the deal together and getting the allocations you need. So it's a little different phenomena.
Yeah, and capital A affordable, what people don't understand about its attractiveness is not just once it's built, it is inflation-adjusted rents. It's also the fee structure early on is very attractive.
You're spot on. I look at it as a barbell to our small A business, because our small A business, although it's done very well from a cash flow and fee management standpoint, it's not the same as the affordable business. But the back ends are very attractive in, call it the small A business, because of promote. On the other hand, the stickiness of the affordable side, particularly from a rentership and cash flow and fee standpoint, is very attractive.
And you mentioned a moment ago, Bob, you've expanded your business into the build to rent business, which would be the way I would describe it is single family homes that you rent rather than sell. Is that how you do it?
We started doing that when we were starting the development, and we've pivoted since then. We're now doing more townhome configurations and vertical construction as well. I think the build for rent space got a little crowded very quickly, and we saw some challenges with it that survived this Road to Housing Act. So we're doing all aspects of, call it non-high rise, you know, anything from single family built for rent up to mid-rise, and in a configuration of townhouse and vertical and so forth, but not high rise.
For our listeners, there's a term of art we use in this business, which is called stick built. It means you don't have to use steel, or certainly not as much steel, to build a townhome as you do for a high rise, which keeps your costs down. Is that part of your strategy, Bob?
It's always been part of our strategy, Spencer. We do not want to price out the renter, whether it's a building we're acquiring and rehabbing, whether it's a building we're trying to build. We're trying to meet the market without trying to create new heights of rent.
Let's just go right back to that last phrase that Bob used, renters by choice rather than renters by need, which is
by necessity.
By necessity. Thank you, Bob. And once you get closer to that capital A affordable, these are renters by necessity. Bob, a big part of your business that you just described is, stop me if I'm off base here, is what I call one of the more traditional strategies within the, call it the workforce or class B business, which is you buy older product, you buy product that might be class B, you renovate it, and you can get return on the capital you put in there in excess of the return you're getting on the initial acquisition. Is that a big part of your strategy?
It's definitely a big part of the strategy, and not to accuse you of oversimplification. A lot of it is made on the margin. A lot of people are doing it, but it's how you do it, how you execute on it, that makes a big difference in overall success or failure in that business. We've seen a lot of, shall we say, startups or newbies come in that found themselves in pretty big difficulties here in the change of cycles. So it's how you do it, how you manage costs, how you manage expenses that really defines success in today's market, because you're not going to get bailed out by outsized growth. You're just not right now. You have to execute.
And I think for our listeners, I mean, I think it seems very attractive. And maybe, Bob, when you were 28 years old, you were maybe doing some of this yourself, buying older product and renovating it and selling it for, or renting it for higher rents. And it sounds very attractive, maybe at the smaller end of the scale, to do it even today for entrepreneurs. But when you're dealing with larger products, for 100 plus unit products, and you think, oh, we'll just paint carpet, put in new refrigerators, improve the cabinetry, yeah, there's a return on that capital that's in excess of what you buy. But if you don't do it right, it could be an enormous risk. Is that a fair warning to our listeners?
That is a very fair warning. And we probably spend more time focusing on analysis, cost analysis, doing the speed of execution, all these things that it's almost like you're manufacturing a car or something where it's going down an assembly line. We're rehabbing in the thousands of units per year. So the execution, the vendor relationships, the speed of it, the choices, all those things start to become very important as opposed to doing a few here and there.
Talk a little bit about your capital structure. I know you raised the workforce fund. Right. Do you have a series of funds? Do you do them some side deals? Tell us just the capital structure of True America.
When we started, we were raising non-discretionary third-party capital deal by deal. Other than my strategic alliance, a partnership with Guardian Life, which is my co-GP, we would raise the LP side, the 90% side, from insurance companies, from opportunity funds, from all sorts of household names throughout the world that are in the equity business. As we evolved, we became a fund manager. So we have a series of funds now. We're halfway through investing our second fund. And in about a year, we'll be on to our third fund and probably have other fund offerings as well. So we're becoming more of a fund manager as well. Although we do have separate accounts, we do have joint venture partners, and we do have the fund. So those are the three main sources that we rotate depending on the situation and the property demands.
And I want our listeners to pay attention to one point that, or all the points, but this is the one I want to focus on for just a moment, that Guardian is a co-GP here. They are not just an investor. They own a piece of the company.
Yes, they do.
And I mention that because I would say until 10 years ago, that was kind of rare. But that that has become in vogue today. I think that there are benefits to having them in the GP side of the equation, not just LPs, that people are beginning to appreciate. Do you agree with that?
I could not agree with you more. And had they not been in that slot, I probably would still be either retired or running my business at Kennedy Wilson. Because when you have an unlimited supply of GP capital, you have more swagger. You have more of an ability to go get deals done. So having them as a partner in the company, they were a real early mover into that space you're talking about, where you're taking a position in an operating company as well as being a GP partner. And they have now repeated that several times in other instances, and they've done a remarkable job doing it. So they were a real early mover in their space.
I like the word you use there. I like the word swagger. It defines what you have, not because you just have deep capital sources, but people should understand how this business really works. We need to have, as brokers or in other professionals in the space, we need to have confidence in our counterparty. And by having a great partner in your GP gives you swagger with brokers and the rest of the community that gives you access to deals that you might not otherwise have had. Is that another benefit to it, Bob?
That is. And the truth is, when we started, even though we were raising the other component, the LP side, the fact that we were backstopped by Guardian, and, you know, I'm an investor myself of a material nature, but, you know, I'm a guy and they're an insurance company, that firepower gave the perception early on that we had complete captive capital. So having that was a big competitive advantage that we were able to utilize throughout our ownership. And as we evolved, we've been able to obviously evolve into the fund space and different things as a result of that start that we had.
Well, I also note in your evolution, you've also evolved into having some investors from Asia. You have in your fund, Japan's, hopefully I pronounce this correctly, Nikkei Electric Railway. You have Kintetsu Real Estate in there. How did you get these Japanese investors into your fund? And what do you say to others that want to get more foreign investors into their vehicle?
As long as they go over there and spend time and don't bother my investors, I'm good with it, you know? Okay. So that, I have to tell you, Spencer, I've been going to Japan for over 20 years.
The key point you made is you got to go there. You can't fax a handshake if anybody still has a fax number on their machines, but you also can't fax a relationship. You have to physically go there. Is that a fair way to put it?
It's a very fair way to put it. And the trust you build by showing up is the trust that then permeates into the relationship later, provided everybody's doing what they say they're going to do. But particularly with Japanese investors, they rely a lot on affinity, trust, friendship, showing up. Probably the best place in the world to do business. It's an incredibly friendly, incredibly honest place to do business.
Well, I just did a Japan U.S. summit in Dallas maybe a month and a half ago, and the enthusiasm for Japanese investors to come back to the U.S. is palpable. The U.S. looks attractive, and the U.S.-Japanese capital relationship, I think, is only going to get stronger.
I couldn't agree with you more. And as I said, I was there about a month ago speaking at the AFIRE conference in a bilingual panel with one of my investors on the panel with me. And you could tell the enthusiasm for all things foreign investment for the Japanese. And they are open for business. There's a sign up that says, come on over, let's do some things together. And it's very encouraging, actually. And I think that, yeah, there have been some cycle timing issues for them, but there's no more loyal people than the Japanese investors. They're incredible.
We've been talking about what we call a K-shaped recovery. I don't want to get all fancy talk here, but fancy talk means the rich are getting richer and people that weren't doing as well aren't thriving as much. Have you seen that same phenomenon? How is that impacting the multifamily sector?
Well, are we talking about from a consumer standpoint or an investor standpoint or both?
I think from a consumer standpoint.
I disagree with that. I'm going to tell you why. The reason why we're able to get rent growth, particularly over the last number of years till this recent period, because the American family's household income has gone up. If you research that, as I know you, that's your middle name research, our average household income when we started 13 years ago that we were targeting was in the 45 to 50,000 range. Now it's in the 70s. Yes, there are more people at the, I call it the entry level of our society in terms of household income, but the middle market household income has gone up. So it may be a K-shaped recovery in that the folks that are at the upper end can invest more and do more. But I think overall, America's doing very, very well, despite a lot of difficult world events, despite phenomenal changes that we're seeing due to AI and, you know, other things. But I don't agree with that. I think the workforce has done pretty good.
So let's shift from the consumer to the investor. So you said the consumer is much stronger than we think, but we did agree that investors have been difficult, particularly on the development side. How are you seeing investor sentiment today?
I would see it as today cautiously optimistic, but very, very discriminatory, very, very careful and very cautious in how they're putting out money and where they're putting it out to and who they're putting it out with. Right now, the sponsor's not in the driver's seat. The equity's in the driver's seat. And so there's a cautious optimism out there. You know, investors aren't just throwing money at any deal that just shows up on their desk. They're looking at 20, 30, 40 deals before they make a decision.
Yeah, and what I'm hearing today is that the market is flush with debt. It is not flush with equity. Is that too much of a simplification?
Yes, it is flush with plenty of debt. There's plenty of equity out there. It's accessing it and getting it to commit that's hard. Maybe I'm mincing words here with you a little bit, but it's not like there's a shortage of people that want to put out equity. It's a matter of them finding opportunities with enough growth that they believe in the business plan that makes sense. And, you know, in multi, unfortunately, yields have come down.
Where would you see you, Bob, True America, on the risk spectrum, core through opportunistic, and how do you like to play it?
We play all different ends of it because we have capital that wants to do core and they're not expecting double-digit returns from that because they understand the whole pricing model. From a risk standpoint, you know, it's the tough one because we don't take wildcat risk. We take very measured risk. I think that anybody that's investing in a value add right now is investing with the hopes that all the forecasts and all the modeling and all the growth percept things are going to come true because they're not underwriting 5 or 6% growth. They're underwriting 3 to 4% growth in most markets at best right now. So the risk is in the business plan itself. Can it be achieved based on the realities of what's going to be happening in the economy in the next 3 to 5 years?
So we've got to prepare for all different scenarios. Do you agree with that?
I do. That's why the use of debt and the use of leverage is very, very important right now in how much you use, because as we saw in this run-up, those that were doing, we'll call it north of 75% financing or using preferred or mezz, found themselves in severe difficulty during a correction period. So I think less debt right now is a better way to go. And that way you can survive a change or a downturn.
We both agreed that there are challenges in multis today, but there are also opportunities because of those challenges for well-capitalized companies like True America. So If you were to say, without giving away the farm here, Bob, where are you seeing some of the best opportunities today, in part because of some of the challenges in the sector?
I think the opportunity set will be deal by deal in various markets. I think there'll be some great opportunities still in the coastal markets and Sunbelt where we see these times up situations where either the sponsor can't hold on or it's a fund that just has to get a redemption. And I think we're only seeing the very early stage of that. This has been a very slow transition. It's actually been one of the longest resets I've seen in my 40-year career. So I think you have to be patient and really look for those sweet spots of opportunity.
So Bob, in addition to being a great podcast guest, you are a podcast host, and we're very fortunate that you've had several of my great colleagues on that show. Tell us about your podcast, what you're doing, and what you're trying to achieve.
Thank you, Spencer. I'm no Spencer Levy, but I try, okay? But I launched Building Better Communities about 3 years ago at a time when I felt people in our industry want to hear thought leadership. They don't want to hear simply that you closed a deal or you sold a deal or you bought a deal. They want to hear how you think. And I felt I wanted to channel the minds of other great real estate people out there that had a great story to tell, and also to talk about how they're building a better community in addition to the great work they're doing. What mark do they want to leave on society? What are their charitable pursuits? And to really cast a better light to people in real estate than maybe exists in the media, because there's a lot of really great people in our industry. So we have featured attorneys, we have featured entrepreneurs, we've featured a lot of founders. It's been a great experience, and we'll continue to do it.
Well, good for you. How often does that show air?
We do about 10 to 12 episodes a year, so about monthly.
And, you know, as a guy who's been around this business for over 30 years, like yourself, what I have found is the nature of communication has changed. Is that part of the reason why you're doing the podcast? Because the nature of the listener has changed? And how are you getting through to that listener? I mean, what's been some of the feedback?
100% agree with you. I think attention spans are shorter. But at the same time, when people are in the car, they have an extra moment, they do like to listen to podcasts because of the verbal nature of it as opposed to just reading. I think you'll find that people don't read as much as they used to. They're listening more in almost every walk of life that they're in. That's part of the genesis of it. We post on LinkedIn, both my personal as well as the company's LinkedIn page, and we also have a following in the tens of thousands of people that regularly listen to us.
Well, keep rocking. The more good podcasts out there, the better. I might recommend a certain podcast guest to you, but that's a conversation for later in the day.
Does his initials have SL in it?
It might. It might. Home series.
Well, I would love to have you on, Spencer. You're a phenom. I'd love to have you on there.
Oh, well, Bob, you're too kind. But the more that you can have thoughtful conversations about what's really going on out there, about the positives of our industry, how we are trying to build a better world out there, I think we're all better off for it. So thank you, Bob, for doing what you do.
Thank you. Thank you for summarizing that, Spencer. That was really well said.
You've been around the space now for 40 years in your current capacity at True America, at Kennedy Wilson, at Heitman and elsewhere. How do you see the next 5 years plan out?
I see the next 5 years as a phenomenal new beginning. I see it as an opportunity to really grow businesses, to grow verticals, to really become, at least in our case, a much broader living company, not just a pure play multifamily company, but a company that really is involved in a deeper way in the residential space, which is why we started a structured finance group, which is why we started a development group, and why we started an affordable group, in addition to our small A business. So I'm a believer. I remain a believer. I think these resets are temporary, and I think the opportunity set will be good. I think we'll get back to orderly immigration, and I think our basic industries in this country will continue to grow and create jobs.
Well, on behalf of the Weekly Take, what a great conversation today with Bob Hart, the president and CEO of True America, one of the largest multifamily owners in the United States with a diversified strategy. Bob, terrific job. Thank you for coming to the show.
Thank you for having me, Spencer. It was wonderful to talk with you.
Wonderful indeed. If you enjoyed learning from Bob Hart's strategies and stories, we've got the wisdom of other real estate entrepreneurs in our archive, and also from leaders at some of the most influential institutions in the country. You can check them all out at cbre.com/theweeklytake or on any podcast platform where you find the show. We'll be back next week with more. For now, it's thanks for joining us. I'm Spencer Levy. Be smart, be safe, be well.